Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save
big time.
For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome to Med Crimes. Fall day.
Oh my god, it's gorgeous outside.
I know, dude.
This is awesome.
It really is.
This is our first podcast.
It's our first podcast.
This is a thing now.
It's an actual thing. There are twinkle lights.
There's twinkle lights.
We have a lab.
We got a plant.
There is a plant.
We have a plant. We have stationery.
There is stationery.
We got our notes.
There's a whole notebook,
mics.
A mouse pad.
We're doing this.
We're basically killing it over here.
This is happening. This is awesome. All right, everyone. So you are listening to the pilot Med Crimes podcast.
Wow, this is a pilot. You're right. This is a pilot.
Excuse me while I fix my language here. I got to learn how to talk over a microphone.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
Kate's always been the microphone girl with the singing. I've always been along for the ride.
Yeah, you've been my muse, though. I don't know about you, but I am like clinging desperately to spooky season. I'm really like, I don't care that Halloween is over.
You've always been the Halloween girl.
I mean,
me,
yeah.
However. Hello, November 1st, Christmas music.
Ew.
Twinkle the lights, feed the Santa, make your cookies.
Wait, feed the Santa? Feed the Santa?
Milk and cookies.
Oh, I see what you're, okay. All right, fine.
It's not all about what presents you're going to get, Kate.
I'm not even thinking about presents. I'm still thinking about trick-or-treating, and my kids have a literal, like, 6-pound sack of candy. And we were just talking about this upstairs, but, like, the kids get to eat, like, a one piece a day.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, my husband and I are, like, sneaking it and, like, are eating it over the sink in the kitchen like a rat.
Ditto.
And my kids are like, wow, we're really eating this candy fast, huh? And I'm like, yep.
I had to fight my 2-year-old to get into his costume. And the entire time he goes, no, I don't want to go trick-or-treating. And in my head, I'm thinking, but mommy wants candy.
Let's just, like, dive into this. This first one, you guys, it is a doozy.
I know nothing about what Kate is about to describe to me, so
yeah.
She's done all the research, and I'm along for the ride on this one, and I gotta say, she told me about it. Is this the one that you told me you thought would be a two-parter?
Yeah, I think this might be a two-parter, because of the just sheer volume and the amount of years that he was given the opportunity to do his terrible, terrible things to people. So I'm thinking that, yeah, we're going to see how things go.
So basically, folks, Kate and I both work in the medical field and we're both mamas, and we just started researching on some of these creeps and some of these people that have just been making all sorts of med crimes, and we want to talk about it
because we really do.
We're the good side of healthcare and they're clearly the bad.
This is very true. And also because I love true crime. I'm a big podcast person. I love watching, like, true crime, like, serial killer documentaries until I can't sleep at night.
I like the Kardashians.
That's basically the dynamic that we're demonstrating here.
We are best friends.
We are.
But we are two very similar people with very similar knowledge.
Yes.
And we're going to do this.
Okay.
So, who's our first guy?
This first guy, his name is Charles Cullen, also known as the Angel of Death Killer. He actually confessed to murdering over 40 patients during his 60-year nursing career.
Wait, 40?
40.
He confessed to 40.
But in subsequent interviews with police, media, and psychologists, he may have been responsible for up to 400 deaths. So I think what that means is that we were able to confirm and, like, you know, identify the actual victims, because what you'll see in the research is that he doesn't even recall a lot of it, and he doesn't even like have the consideration to like record people's names. So like it's an estimation.
All right.
But the ones that we were able to confirm, there are 40 of them.
Okay.
Isn't that crazy?
Let's get into this.
But if that's true, if he did in fact kill over 400 people, that makes him the most prolific serial killer of all time. Isn't that crazy?
And he was a nurse.
A registered nurse.
Took all the same boards.
Yeah. Well, no, because this was a lot of years ago.
True. But
so
he probably had to do it with a number two pencil.
I mean, yeah, probably. So Charles Edmund Cullen, he was born February 22nd, 1960 in West Orange, New Jersey. His parents were Edmund Cullen and Florence Ward Cullen. He was the last of eight children. Now, he was born into a devout Irish Catholic family. His father, Edmund, he was 57 years old when Charles was born.
What?
Yeah. 57.
And my husband complains that he was 41.
Yeah, no. So he was really, this guy was really old. Yeah, exactly.
You can give me children for the next 14 years.
So he by all accounts was a really good guy. However, unfortunately, he died suddenly September 17th, right after Charlie was born. So Charlie was only 7 months old and he never really knew his dad.
Okay. So now he's basically growing up without a father.
Exactly. And so this left his mom, Florence, to raise the eight kids alone by herself. Now, she had emigrated to the U.S. from England after the Second World War. And in interviews, sadly, Cullen describes his childhood as miserable. There's a lot of what seems like severe mental illness beginning at a very, very young age. There was definitely bullying. There was definitely a very bizarre dynamic with the mom, and we'll get into it.
Oh.
So he recounted being heavily bullied by his siblings and specifically by his sister's boyfriends. So his family, he had all of his siblings were older. He was the last of eight. And so he
was
had
there
a lot
like
of
a big gap that you know of.
There was a pretty sizable gap. And I know that these siblings were like grown and in and out of the house and somewhat transient in his life. So they would like bring home people and stay like in the upstairs level of the house. And these guys that specifically his sister would bring over were like unsavory characters. And he was subjected to physical and mental abuse. He was also bullied by the kids at school. He never really did well. He engaged really poorly. And his mom was like the one constant source of support in his life.
Oh, so he had a good mom role model.
He had a really good mom role model. And she really did try really hard with him. He was like the youngest baby. She never remarried. And she was spread super, super thin between her eight kids.
Well, hello.
I know. So he recalls anytime he's asked, he's like, my relationship with my mom was good. It was solid.
Usually isn't that like the base of these things when they talk about how terrible their parents were and I had a terrible childhood, you know?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So
good job, Cullen's mama.
Yeah, I know. Good job. We like her. We like her. She really did try. So trigger warning here because we're going to be talking about suicide at a young age, unfortunately. So at age nine, he made his first of several suicide attempts.
Oh.
And what he tried doing was drinking chemicals from a chemistry set that he got at school.
What?
I know. I don't know what the chemicals were, but he tried to ingest them and it landed him in the hospital for a few days.
How? At 9 years old to even know that if that was, you know what I mean? To know that if I drink this, this could kill me.
Well, I mean...
And to even have those
exactly
thoughts at 9 years old.
I can't imagine what kind of place you have to be in and whether or not he really understood the consequences of that. I mean, he was nine. I don't know that he really, like, had a real deep understanding.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Some of the trauma, too, might come from the fact that he really considered himself a late-life mistake to his parents. Because I believe that there was, like, his siblings, and then it was kind of a several-year gap before he was born. So he really I don't think his mom ever really made him feel like that, but he thought of himself as a mistake. And he recalls, you know, the childhood in West Orange, New Jersey, as, like, their home. He said it was a dark and unhappy place. The transience of his siblings... there was a lot of drug addiction among his siblings. There was pregnancy among his siblings. And like I said, they were really in and out of his life, in and out of the house and creating a lot of just like disharmony in the house. And I think that really had a huge effect on him. And he really just struggled to fit in like at home and in the school, unfortunately.
So it's almost like he felt like an outcast from birth.
Exactly. Like he was an outcast in his family and he was an outcast at school. And his siblings, who he really barely knew because they were much older, just, you know, brought these horrible people home and were never a constant in his life. So really his mom was like the pillar in his life.
So at the moment, I'm starting to feel bad for this guy, but I'm pretty sure once we get a few pages further, I might feel a little less bad.
I mean, yeah. That's, like, going to be a running theme here.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So we're going to, like, identify.
It's pulling at the mama heartstrings here.
It really is. It's very sad, isn't it? This whole thing is very, very sad on, like, many different levels, because not only was this kid, you know, he, so many cries for help. So many cries for help. It's just unfathomable how many times this kid was like, somebody, for the love of God, please help me. But in the time period, you know, in the early 70s, this resources for, you know, a 9-year-old kid who's trying to commit suicide,
and I imagine, are very limited. The way that they act out, it just is coded as, he's a bad kid.
Exactly. He's a bad kid, and just sequester him and make him feel worse about himself, essentially, is how that goes. So his grades were never really great. Now, fast forward to his senior year of high school. This was in 1977. His mother was tragically killed in a car wreck. Now, one of his sisters was driving, and she was completely unharmed. So this was just absolutely devastating for him. This was like...
Tell me again, how old was he?
He was 17 years old. Ugh. So he was 17. It was in 1977.
Still a baby.
And I mean, his mom was like the only light in his life, and the rest of everything was just so, so dark, right? You know? And he recalls being furious with the hospital, because when she was transported to the hospital, he went to the hospital and said, I really want to see my mom's body. You know, he knew that she passed away, but he wanted to view the body, as, you know, mm-hmm. many times that does happen. And the hospital, mm-hmm. exactly. And the hospital essentially told him, I'm sorry, she's already been cremated.
What?
Which I couldn't really find any information particularly on that. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that might be. But
interesting.
I know. Very interesting. So that's absolutely furious. So, like, what are you talking about? I don't think so. So I don't know what happened. Maybe he was just told, you know, the wrong thing by the wrong person. And
maybe
it just...
they told him that because maybe she was so disheveled, they were worried about traumatizing
it. It could have been. And for whatever reason, that ended up just really...
I mean, maybe there's
really...
this doctor that's looking at this 17-year-old kid thinking the best thing for him is to not see his mother.
Exactly. So, I mean, if she was killed in a car wreck, she probably was not physically in the best shape.
Right, exactly. You know?
Yeah, so he is not in a good place.
That stinks.
Right? It's like a huge bummer. So
you are at 17. Your dad mm-hmm. died. You never knew him. There's potential abuse things there. Mm-hmm. Your siblings are not really part of your life. You're in and out. And now the one good thing that you had is gone.
Is completely gone. So he, at this point, just like could not continue school. He was completely inconsolable. So there was another suicide attempt, which landed him in the hospital. Most of his suicide attempts, you're going to notice, were, like, ingestion. He would always, like, take pills.
So is this his second one since being 9 years old?
I believe so. Okay. I couldn't find, like, actual records of each suicide attempt. They only kind of, like, came out during interviews mm-hmm. and such. At this point, he drops out of high school. This is his senior year. He drops out completely.
And we're in what year?
This is 1977.
All right.
And he drops out of high school, and he enlists in the Navy.
Admirable.
I know. Admirable. You know, he was trying to, I think, better his life and, like, get some structure in his life, but unfortunately the Navy life was, like, no kinder to him. That he just never fit in, and that followed him through the Navy. Okay. So he was bullied a lot, he was hazed by his colleagues, and he did not cope well at all. He did not fit in. He, despite all of this, though, he rose to the rank of Petty Officer 3rd Class, which... my understanding is that's, like, a pretty respectable rank. So good for him. He, underwater life, too, though, itself was really rough. So, like,
now he's in a closed capsule in a submarine with these people who are not kind to him.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, you know, the military is the military. I mean, it's kind of like you take the stuff and roll with it. But for someone who has that kind of history.
Exactly. And then... one thing that was really prevalent in the military at that time, too, was drinking. And especially in the Navy, alcohol was one of the ways to, like, pass the time. So at this point in his life is when he began drinking.
As is
really
with every career.
Yeah. Sure. So this was really common in the Navy back then. So he had access to a lot of alcohol, but when his alcohol ran out, he actually would drink Listerine.
Aww.
Like, mouthwash. He would drink anything. He was a very private person, like, physically private, and one of the things that you have to do was, like, take a drug test you know, and oftentimes these were monitored, and it, you would have, like, another sailor there with you, like, monitoring
making
the drug
sure
test.
It's CRP.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, in front of another sailor, he refused to urinate. He would not pee in a cup. And this was the first case where he was, like, disciplined, because it was, like, an insubordination issue.
So, and he didn't encounter this type of practice until he was actually well
no.
into the Navy?
No.
No, nothing.
Apparently
boot
not.
Camp.
Yeah. Right. And then he faced a lot of disciplinary action, like, through his naval career. But this was, like, sort of the first one. And then, he had other little things too. What he really enjoyed from the Navy, though, was the medical stuff. He found that when he was assigned to helping the naval physician or the naval provider, like, administer vaccines and help with exams, he got to participate in all of that. And he found that all really, really fascinating. And I think that's where he sort of developed his...
He's finding his niche.
He's finding his niche. And I think he found it there. So at one point, like... in his career, this is sort of the boiling point. Now, he, like I said, he had faced a lot of disciplinary action, and nobody really liked him. They all felt he was really weird. Now, while he was in the Navy, too, he tried to commit suicide a bunch of times with ingestion. And one time, from drinking the Listerine, he actually landed in the hospital with poisoning from methyl salicylate acid, which is literally the oil of wintergreen flavoring that is in the mouthwash, and that I guess if you ingest massive amounts can, like, cause some issues. So he
and
was
so
hospitalized
still
for
at
that.
This point, no psych services,
nothing
in the late 70s. Oil of wintergreen.
Oil of wintergreen. I know, right? Almost,
is it a candle?
I mean, I'm sure they have, like, wintergreen candles, but I would not, like, want to actively burn a candle that smells like fucking mouthwash, personally.
True.
I mean, give Frank a pumpkin pie. Or like a cotton, like a...
apple cider donut.
So after this attempt, this suicide attempt, he was transferred over to a different boat. So he was transferred to a supply boat. And then in March of 1984, he was subsequently discharged from the Navy. The reason that he was discharged was never really disclosed. It's thought that it was a medical discharge because he had so many behavioral issues.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's what it is thought to be.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Now, let's talk a little bit about his mental health, like, in general. So he estimates...
Not good.
Exactly. Clearly not good. So he estimates that he's had upwards of 12 to 20 suicide attempts total throughout his life. 12 to 20 times.
Prior to him even committing what we're...
Like, through
what
his
we
life.
Haven't gotten
like, this
to.
Is
okay.
what he tells us, like, through
right.
his life.
All right.
So... his method is almost always ingestion, like I said. So at age 9, it was the chemicals. Age 17, following his mom's death, it was, quote, pills. He doesn't really know what it was. But he often, like, mixed tablets with alcohol. And, in fact, after the Navy, he was using alcohol really regularly. It was, like, really part of his life. So he often fantasized about suicide when he was not attempting suicide. He was thinking about attempting suicide and ending his life, and he would sit and just, like, think about ways. Like, what are other ways that I could end my life?
Oh,
what
gosh.
Are other ways that I could kill myself?
Oh, boy.
And there's really no record of him receiving any sort of mental health as a child, despite his many suicide attempts, which were an obvious warning sign and an obvious cry for help. Now, following the attempts in the Navy, there, like I said, there was speculation that the reason for his discharge was that his mental health was obviously breaking down. Following his discharge from the Navy in March of 84 is when he decided, you know what, this medical stuff is really fascinating to me. I'm gonna pursue a career in nursing. And back in the 70s and 80s, male nurses were very, very uncommon. But yeah. he went and enrolled in Mountainside Hospital School of Nursing in Montclair, New Jersey in March of 84. It really
Mountainside.
Does.
Mountainside.
It really does. And you know what? He did really well in this school. And his mental health while he was in school was pretty stable. He has really good memories from being in school. He loved anatomy, physiology. He loved pharmacology. That all really fascinated him. But
how about micro? Because that one's fun.
We can all talk about how micro. I actually liked micro. Devin.
F micro. Me, I'm pretty sure I passed micro with the turbo shot coffee that I had the night before.
Also, you're welcome, because I'm pretty sure I helped you study for micro.
And probably bought me the turbo shot coffee.
I might have.
There's that.
I bought you a lot of coffee.
Can we just disclose how many times she changed her clothes throughout one throughout one day?
I want to clarify to you that I really don't do that anymore. There's just no fucking time. Like, my kids will not leave me alone.
There was...
If I get to get dressed in the morning, it's a fucking miracle.
There was the outfit to get dressed in the morning that probably involved at least two pairs of pants and maybe three tops. Then there was the outfit for class. Then she needed to clean the dorm room. So once the dorm room was clean, then there was the doing the homework outfit, which probably involved pajama phase one.
Well, I mean, so first of all, you really can't, comfortably do homework unless you're in pajamas. That's my argument. Because I didn't really like sitting at a desk if I could avoid it. I was gonna, curl up on my fucking little bunk bed, in a little...
While I was snoring on the bottom.
Yeah. Oh my god, the snoring. We can talk about that, too. Anyway, back to Charles.
More roomy talks throughout the rest of the podcast episodes.
Yes. It's so fascinating. So, back to Mr. Cullen, doing really, really well at Mountainside Hospital School of Nursing in Montclair, New Jersey. And he loved anatomy and physiology. He loved pharmacology. He loved learning all of that. He was the only male student in his entire student body at the time. But he did so well that he was actually elected president of his nursing class.
Oh!
Isn't that awesome?
All right.
I know, right? Now, to put himself through school, he worked three jobs at once, and he worked at a Dunkin' Donuts.
How did he find the time? They had Dunkin's in the 80s?
Nursing school also, I do believe, is a lot different than it is now. Nursing school is its own very much full-time job. Yes. But I don't think it's the way that it used to be.
All right.
So he worked at Dunkin' Donuts. He worked at Roy Rogers, which is another, fast food coffee, I think, joint. I don't think we have them around
don't
here in
have
New
ice
England.
Cream?
Do they have ice cream?
I don't know.
Sounds
someone find that out for us, because anywhere I can get ice cream,
if somebody could let us know what a Roy Rogers is, we're really not familiar, clearly. Now
forgive us.
Forgive us. I'm sorry if we offend. We don't want to offend anybody. He did all that to pay for school, and it was at Roy Rogers where he met Adrienne Baum. Which she was a manager at the Roy Rogers branch that he worked at.
Uh-oh.
And she was also working herself through school. She was earning a business degree because she's a bad bitch.
Did he get together with the boss?
I mean, stay tuned. Yes, he did. Stay tuned. So he really admired her ambition, and he thought she was sophisticated compared to all the West Orange girls that he was used to. She was working through business school. She was super smart. At the time that they met, Adrienne actually had a boyfriend, but during her time there, they had split, and then Cullen just
scooped his way right in.
Oh, yeah, he was like, bitch, cry on my shoulder.
I want to know if he was wearing the sailor outfit when he did that.
I mean, at Roy Rogers, I doubt it. Although,
true, but we all like a boy in uniform. Am I right, ladies?
I think he was well out of the Navy in this period. Although, I don't know.
Do they let you keep your uniforms when you're out? If you don't officially retire?
I think maybe you have to turn them in. Again, anybody who's familiar with the military...
Please, let us know.
Military practices.
There's a lot of subjects
in the early 80s, specifically surrounding returning of uniforms. Please message us and let us know how that happened.
We do apologize for the areas of knowledge that we lack in.
There's a lot.
Clearly. But if you need someone to save your life, we got your back.
Yeah,
so
we got your back.
That.
Yes, exactly. My girl Devin here is a registered nurse. A bachelor's prepared registered nurse.
Damn
and
straight.
She is one of the smartest human beings that I know.
My friend Kate here. Girl is a nurse practitioner.
Hey.
She went and got her nurse practitioner license while raising a child, while working full-time as an RN.
I did.
Who does that? Who has the time? Clinical just rotations, 12-hour night shifts while having a baby?
I know. My husband totally is
It's
amazing.
Truly amazing you found
he's
the time.
He's a smoke show, and I love him, and he's the only reason that I was able to accomplish literally anything.
I'm still amazed that you found the time to have your second child.
Oh.
I mean, let's think about this. Insane.
I was very much waddling through my last clinical rotation. Like, very wobbly. Like, I was, like, people were, like, following me around, like, hoping my water wouldn't break as I, like, went and saw patients.
Not today, Kate. Not today.
Not today. Thankfully, Benjamin did wait a little while to be born, and I was able to complete that rotation. So, we're back at Roy Rogers. Charlie and Adrienne are hitting it off. She's broken up with her boyfriend. Charlie swoops in there, and he just, like, scoops that shit up. And he was infatuated. The relationship moved really quickly.
First love, I'm assuming.
First love, absolutely. Yep. And, I mean, we're going to see here that there's a pattern of, like, codependency behavior. With him, and especially with the women in his life.
Mm.
And he just, like, dumps everything.
Doesn't have his mama anymore, so
no,
he hops on
exactly.
the women board.
So he's like, this is my person now. Like, you're my person. So Adrienne recalls that Charlie was, like, shy and wide-eyed. But once he opened up, she thought that he was really confident. She thought he was really funny. And she liked that he was really serious about his nursing career also. He showered her, absolutely showered her with gifts, and was, quote-unquote, the model boyfriend. And her family really liked him. He went, like, up and over the top. Like, over the top. And he, like, lots of big romantic gestures and, like, the stuff that, you know, we all swoon over. But with him, like, it was a lot. Like, he does this, like, routinely. And psychiatrists later theorized that this is all part of Charlie's, like, pattern of, like we said, codependence, especially with the females in his life, all stemming from his dependence with his mom. Now, 6 months after they became a couple, they were engaged.
Fast track.
That was really very much on the fast track. So the week after Charlie graduated from nursing school, which was in 1986, they got married. And everything just, like, seemed like a fairy tale. Everything was going really, really well. They had a short honeymoon over in Niagara Falls. And shortly after that, actually the week after they got back, was when he began his first nursing job. And he began working at St. Barnabas Medical Center.
So right now, things are looking up for Charlie.
Things are all looking really good.
Things are looking up for Charlie.
His mental health has stabilized a little since he's had Adrienne in his life.
He's
not been drinking as much. He's really just, like, being the model person. And Adrienne really had no suspicion. Although, they had a lot, actually, they did have a lot of discussions about his mental health. And he was actually very open with her. And he told her about his past suicide attempts, and he told her all about his past drinking.
As you should with
that,
your spouse.
Of course. And so all of that he was very upfront about.
Mm-hmm.
So he began his first job then in 1984 at St. Barnabas Medical Center in their burn unit. So I have never personally worked in a burn unit, but from what I know about burn units, I mean, that is a grind. And it's an amazing specialty. And the people that do it, oh my goodness, what a special, special group of people.
Every nurse, every doctor has their niche.
Yes.
And you know what? The ones that can do that and treat those patients, God bless you.
It's really incredible. So, and this was the only certified burn unit at the time in the state of New Jersey. So, I mean, they got, like, referred, they received all
the worst
of these
of the worst.
Bad people. Exactly. Yeah. So the burn unit treated a slew of burn injuries from car accident victims, house fires, industrial spills, and often small children.
Aww.
Now, the severity of which varied from, like, minor injuries to extreme life-threatening situations. And these extreme burns could often render victims completely unrecognizable. Now, one of Charlie's jobs was wound care, meaning that he was tasked with removing necrotic burnt skin from the wound beds. Ugh. And even for critical
care
nurses...
Which I've heard has got to be one of the most painful things.
I've heard the same.
There is.
I've heard the same. I've heard that it's absolutely... Although, you know, when you have a third-degree burn, though, a full-thickness burn, a lot of times it also ablates that nerve. So a lot of people don't actually have feeling. But that even for, like, a seasoned... critical care nurse, this is incredibly gruesome. I mean, the stuff that this guy must have seen was really pretty insane. The smell, the pain, and just the tiresome work of the replacing these profound fluid and electrolyte losses that come from like massive burns, placing lines for access, monitoring. The kids were really tough for Charlie, and that was really tough.
As is for anyone.
You know, it would be tough for me, too, and he's not a parent at this point, but I think I can speak for all parents, you know, that really love and care about their kids, as most parents do, that treating kids who are in a life-threatening situation, I mean, that's
tough. Can't do it.
That's really tough. Some people can, some people can't. I don't treat children, so that's... You know, I would have a lot of a hard time with the pediatric rotation.
It's tough for a lot of people. Yeah. I was the nursing student who kind of strung to the higher teen patients because closer I could get more to adults. Not only just this, not this fear that I was going, you know, afraid of working with children, but just obviously the heartstrings and then the parents. The parents relying on me as the nurse, or at that time the nursing student, to help their child. And it's just, oh my gosh, it's like having two patients.
It is. It's like having two patients.
And no, I stuck with the teenagers, and now the elderly.
Yes, same. And I have a certification in adult gerontology acute care. So if that tells you anything, it's that I did not even bother getting certified to care for children because it just bothers me so much. I can't do it.
We love our babies.
We do. We love our babies so much.
And we love the ones that are able to take care of our babies.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So the big thing that bothered Charlie about the kids is that at the time, excuse me, in the 80s, the adults were receiving like morphine and Demerol and all of these nice pain medications, but the kids couldn't get anything other than... Yep, other than Tylenol number 3, which is Tylenol with codeine.
Right.
So that was
They didn't have baby doses of those.
They did
things.
Not, no. At that time, they were not dosing kids with medications like that. So these kids would undergo these extensive surgeries to prevent, like, the contractures and keep the joints mobile and graft the skin and get debridements. And they would wear these, like, big pressure suits to aid in the swelling, you know, and minimize the scarring. And what these kids were getting was like, here's some Tylenol with a little bit of codeine. Like, good luck with that. So, I mean, for me, that would really be rough for me too. That's really bothersome.
Let me tell you, I love me some Tylenol with codeine. I mean, good luck trying to get it now. I mean, it's like pulling teeth to get it. No pun intended. But I mean, when you're talking extensive burns all over your body, that's barely going to be touching the surface.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
These poor children.
Yeah. It's really so awful. Man. So Charlie took his job and he worked night shift exclusively, and he, in his profession, really excelled, and his co-workers were really a big fan of him and they really enjoyed working with him. He was very motivated. He was smart. And I mean, by all accounts, very early on, he did really, really well in that role. And he enjoyed working on the burn unit. Now, in October 1987, Adrienne and Charlie bought a house, and Adrienne is her name, and I wrote it two different, it's Adrienne, and I had to look up how to pronounce it to make sure I was
pronouncing
it right.
So it's not Adrienne.
No, it's not really Adrienne, it's Adrienne.
Adrienne.
Yep.
Adrienne.
Thank you for singing that.
You're welcome.
Girl. So Adrienne got a job as a computer programmer, and she was not thrilled about that. Like, her degree. No offense to
any computer programmers out there.
God, Devin.
I know. I apologize. Very smart computer programmers.
Thank you.
There is a desperate need for you in this world.
There really is, for real. We love you guys.
Thank you for what you do.
And what she liked was business, but that was what her degree was in. But she was...
And that could take them places, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So she was happy to get this job, but she was like, yeah, you know, it's probably not a forever thing. You know,
and, you know, for a woman who probably wants to have children.
Exactly. Now, so in February 1988, Adrienne was pregnant. Here comes the baby. So this really shifted the dynamic in the house. And obviously when a baby, like, comes, there's a big shift in the dynamic.
No kidding. Like, no, nothing really changes at all, ever. It's completely the same.
It makes everything better. And it just, you know, I mean, it does. It makes everything better. But also it really just changes, you know, how you interact with your spouse.
And, for sure.
You know, a lot of things change. So if you have kids, you know exactly what we're talking about.
So were they happy about this pregnancy?
They were. Oh, they were. So all things really shifted. So Charlie was overjoyed. He was so excited, but a bit obsessive. And
Over
Adrienne's baby, specifically. So she was really feeling neglected. And the baby was everything. It's all he talked about. It's all he thought about. It's like, it was like this huge, big turning point. And then
can't forget the mamas, people.
Exactly. And that fall in 1988, Adrienne gave birth to their daughter, Shauna.
Oh,
I know. Now, Shauna Charlie. Cullen. I know. Shauna Cullen. It's nice, right? So, unfortunately, Charlie had a tough time, like, allocating and dividing his affections. So, like, before, Adrienne was everything. And he was like, I'm gonna, like, shower you in gifts, shower you in affection, make you just, like, feel like you're the queen of the universe. And then, like, the baby comes along.
Which is the way you should do it, folks. Men.
Thank you. Yeah, take note. Gentlemen, take note. But also, not note of this, because Charlie really had a tough time, like, allocating and dividing his affections. Like, it's like he had to pick one.
He could not love both.
Exactly. So he couldn't, like, love and shower Adrienne in you know, affection and love, and also, like, love this baby. It's like it was either or. So that was
not necessary for all you future fathers out there. You can love the mama just as much as the baby.
Yeah. And now Adrienne also had said in interviews that at first, I mean,
that's going to be really hard for a postpartum mom.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, we have both been through the postpartum hormones.
Yes.
And to just think that all of a sudden your husband, I mean, it's wonderful that he's bonding with that child, but you're going through hell too. You're going through that fourth trimester.
100%.
And he just, boom.
Yeah.
All to the baby.
And then it gets even worse and weirder. So,
oh, man.
So even like with that, he was starting to sort of ignore Adrienne a little bit, and then he starts to his smittenness with the baby starts to fade. So as the, like, he
was,
you know,
she crying all night long.
No, it's just like the baby wasn't like this shiny new thing anymore. So he was like, okay, I guess I'm like over the magic, newness. You know, newness. And then he was starting to like feel more the frustration piece, you know, like the up all night crying, the constant feedings and things like that.
That it's just sure not all joy and pancakes.
Exactly. So, sidebar, this family had a dog. It was a Yorkie named Lady, and Yorkies are really cute.
Mm-hmm.
We love a Yorkie. Now, after the baby, they also got this new puppy, which, like, if you have a baby and then are like, oh, let's just, like, also get a new puppy.
Nope.
Like.
Wrong.
For
it's like having two babies.
For anybody out here there who has done this, like, yay for you, but, like. Girl.
Good. Where do you get your energy?
Honestly, I'm like, I have, you know, barely enough like energy to just like lift my head off the pillow in the mornings. Like, for reals.
I barely have enough energy to do anything. I mean, first of all.
It's so true. Now, it was another Yorkie, and it was meant to be like a companion for Lady. Lady was like a little older. And then one morning, Adrienne left for work on one of Charlie's days off. So I think he had maybe worked the night before, because you remember he was working night shift. And so he came home and like sort of has the day off to sleep and whatever. So Adrienne left for work and Charlie had the day off. And when she got home, the puppy was just gone. And Charlie like was alarmingly like fine. He was like fine about it. And she was like, so where's the puppy? And he was like, oh, well, I had gone for a walk and it like ran away. Like, it got out and it just like ran away.
Cover up.
Right. And Adrienne was like confused. She's like, I need more information.
Right.
Like, where were you?
And did also, you look like, for the puppy?
And also like, she was like, wait a minute. So you just like went for a walk like without the baby? And then at that point he like changed his story abruptly and was like, no. You know what happened? I had just opened the door. And the dog, like, ran out, and I just, like...
Red flag.
Seriously.
Red flag, folks.
This was, like, the first of some kind of, like, red flag, like, odd behavior. And at one point, she even started suspecting that Charlie was giving the baby cold medicine, like, to help the baby sleep. Like, so that he could, like, sleep on his days when he came back from working
night
shifts.
So, working night shift instead of playing daddy during the day.
He's just like, here's some cold medicine.
Here, take a nap with me. Here's some drugs.
Right.
No. So no, no, no.
She had strong suspicions about this, and they just fought. They fought about this.
I would too.
And he is gaslighting the shit out of her and is like, "You're crazy. Like, I can't believe you would suspect that I do that. Like, what's wrong with you?" And of course,
red flag number two.
She really just started feeling like crazy, like gaslit. Like,
so this is the point in the life, in his whole life story, where he really starts to turn narcissist.
Yeah, I mean, he really is spiraling back into sort of this depression cycle that he was in earlier. Now, like, the novelty of this pretty new wife and this pretty new baby seems
it's all worn
to be
off.
Wearing off.
His exhaustion has now turned into mental health issues.
Exactly. So he's, like, spiraling down. Adrienne is starting to feel really alone. And even when he's home, she's like, he's like a shell of himself. Like, he's not even really talking to me anymore. She started confiding in her family and friends, who all sort of brushed it off. And, you know, back in, you know, the 80s, it was like, well, you know, you're to sort of be this, like, dutiful wife. And, you know, he's probably exhausted. He's earning a lot of money working these night shifts. And, you know, it's a lot for him. And
so they're telling her to give him a break.
Basically. And she did. And for a while, she did. She really gave him the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. She brushed it off. And he started spending a lot of time in their basement. Now, one afternoon, this was sort of like an event that really just like shot up the red flag for Adrienne. Now, there's a neighborhood dog named Queenie, who I believe was a corgi, I read somewhere, which I love corgis. I love a corgi. I love the little corgi.
We got Yorkies and corgis here, folks.
Yes, Yorkies and corgis. So this is a corgi named Queenie, and she belonged to their neighbor. Now, this dog was often found wandering through the Collins yard and like was just super friendly, and the neighbors were friendly, so they all were like, hey, you know, like cute, like Queenie, come into our house. And mm-hmm. Queenie would even just like go in the house and like eat with the dogs and like hang out with the Yorkies and like play and party, and the neighbors like hit it, were fine with it. And so that happened a lot. So one day Adrienne got a knock on the door, and she goes and answers the door, and it's her neighbor, and she says, hey, have you guys seen Queenie? And Adrienne's like, no, I actually haven't seen her in like a while. Now they look around a little bit. They found Queenie in the alley, the sort of gap alley that was between the neighbor's house and their house.
Oh boy.
And the dog was dead.
Oh boy.
And it looked as like there was some foam and blood around her mouth, like she had gotten
so then
into
she
something
was
or
given
was poisoned.
So, yeah.
Yes. So the suspicion was that this dog was poisoned. And Adrienne immediately had a feeling that it was Charlie. She couldn't really tell why, but just, you know, there was just like this
girls.
Very unsettling feeling that mm-hmm. it was Charlie. And she often heard like strange noises coming from the basement. And she did report a couple of times that Charlie would take Lady, their Yorkie, down into the basement. She would hear the dog like cry and whine and yelp like it was being hurt and abused. Mm-hmm. And she would go downstairs and be like, what the fuck are you doing to my dog? And he'd be like, I'm training her. Like, I'm just training her. We're doing obedience training. And it would really, like, piss Charlie off that she was, like, in his space. So she was just, like, back off. So all of this really just, like, made it seem like to Adrienne, like, you know, something's going on. I don't know what's going on, but something's going on.
So June of 88.
June of 1988 was when he tells us that he...
So his daughter's like, what, 4 months old?
Yes, 4 months old. So he committed his first murder at this time, or that's at least what he tells investigators. So,
at the hospital.
Exactly.
And we're not talking about the dog.
So what he tells us he does is that he administered a male patient a lethal dose of insulin. And this was never confirmed because, again, he cared for hundreds and hundreds of patients. He couldn't even recall the guy's name, but this is what he later told investigators. This is in June of 88. Now, his first confirmed murder was in 1988 also, and the victim's name was Judge John Yengo, and he was admitted with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And it, if any of you are not familiar with Stevens-Johnson syndrome, it is...
This is where Kate comes in.
This is where I come in. So this is a serious life-threatening condition. It's very, very rare, and it's thought to be it's typically a reaction to something, a reaction to a medication or a product or whatever, and it's characterized by painful blistering rash that spreads throughout the body, and it sloughs the skin. And these patients are often transferred to burn centers because it's treated very similarly to a full body or full thickness burn.
Right.
So, now Colin admits that he administered a lethal dose of insulin, which killed this guy. and he is the only named victim at St. Barnabas at that hospital. And then the other piece of why we really can't even identify a lot of these victims is because many of the medical records at St. Barnabas from this time were lost or destroyed.
What?
And so we will get more into that, but a lot of it, I believe, strongly believe, was because it was to cover up a lot of his actions. The hospital was afraid of getting sued.
Ugh.
So the hospital administrators all just like lost the records. We'll talk about it. So the thing is too, all of these patients came in with like these big medical issues, a lot of comorbidities, and like these massive burn patients did not have a good prognosis. So oftentimes nobody got like an autopsy or toxicology because
they just assumed they died from their illness while they were there.
Exactly. So that was like his little, you know,
that was his segue into murder.
Exactly. Mm. Now, insulin, if anyone's not familiar, is typically given to diabetic patients to aid in the control of blood sugar. And when it's given in correct doses to patients who really need it, who are prone to hyperglycemia, it can help to keep your blood sugar stable and in safer levels. Now, if the insulin
given too much, however,
or if it's given to a non-diabetic patient, it can result in a life-threatening hypoglycemia or low blood sugar, and that can cause like seizures and arrhythmias and coma and death if it's not treated quickly. So he used insulin really frequently, and what he liked to do was spiking bags of plain IV fluid and heparin with like large amounts of insulin. He would draw entire vials of insulin and just shoot them into the bags.
Clearly, this is why there's a lot of practice with when you're giving insulin to have the two nurses check the dose.
Yes, and actually that, we'll talk about that.
Did that get developed from this?
It sure did.
Because that was like nursing student 101.
I know, and we'll talk about that. So the issue too there is that these burn patients are getting bolused with liter after liter after liter after liter of fluid. That's part of how you resuscitate a burn victim,
because you're severely dehydrated.
You have a massive fluid loss and electrolyte loss through these burns, mm-hmm. and so you have to rapidly replace that. So these patients were just getting
constantly
bolused with hundreds of units of insulin, and it ended very, very badly.
Oh,
whoops,
boy.
I'm smacking the mic. I'm using my hands.
She's getting excited.
This is what I live for.
She's getting excited.
Live for, oh man. Okay, so around this time, narcotic medications were kept under lock and key and carefully documented. Like if you had to go give a dose of morphine, you would have to log it out, and it's still the practice. And drugs like insulin, though, were not closely monitored back then, and they were routinely kept as like floor stock. You could just like go in the closet and grab
your bottle.
Vial of insulin and like go do your thing. It was very easily accessible, so that made it one of his first choice drugs. Now, Charles worked at St. Barnabas Medical Center until 1991, and on February 11th of 1991, a pharmaceutical nurse named Pam Allen got a hold of an IV bag that appeared to have been tampered with, and she noticed that the rubber stopper on the bottom of the bag had been pierced.
Good job, Pam. Go, Pam!
She really tried hard, man. We like Pam. So, and she noticed that the bag was, like, so full. It was, like, packed full to the point that the bag was, like, leaking out of the little rubber stopper.
Like, more, say, than the liter that should have been in there.
I mean, there's always, like, a little bit of squish to the bags, right? You know? She immediately reported this to her supervisors. The IV bag was a bag of IV heparin, actually, which is an anticoagulant, and it's often used to treat blood clots and thrombotic events like strokes and heart attacks. And this bag was tested in their pathology lab, and it contained massive amounts of insulin. So, 3 days later, a patient in the CCU named Anna Byers, she was admitted for an NSTEMI. She was placed on an IV heparin drip. 30 minutes later, she was cold, clammy, confused, nauseous, and shaky. All classic signs of hypoglycemia.
Yep.
So, staff immediately picked up on that, checked her finger stick, and it was undetectably low.
Uh-oh.
So, staff gave her IV dextrose to bring up her critically low blood sugar, and she was so loaded with insulin at this point that she crashed right through. So despite giving her the IV dextrose,
because you can't keep up,
it just kept dropping.
She started to crash, and then she's crashing hundreds
of units of insulin. So she was kept on dextrose, which did keep her alive throughout the day. And the following day, they stopped her heparin because they were planning on bringing her to the cath lab because she had had a heart attack. So you stop the heparin before they go to the cath lab. Now, she went to the cath lab for her revascularization procedure. Her blood sugar stabilizes. So now she had her cardiac cath. The cath showed multivessel disease, which essentially means you need an open heart surgery and you need to go back on the heparin because they weren't able to stent anything open. So she was placed right back on the heparin after her procedure, and all of a sudden her blood sugar becomes completely unstable and she's in the same boat. So down the hall, a patient named Fred Belf was in the same exact boat. Now, staff began making, like, connections between the heparin bags and the hypoglycemic events because, like, these people were fine as long as they're not on their heparin.
And now they're on heparin and they crash, which should not happen.
So, same thing happened. This guy, Belf, was unhooked from his heparin. His hypoglycemic events completely stopped.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time.
For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
So the nurses had the foresight to just take that same bag of heparin that was hooked up to Belf and the tubing. They disconnected him completely, and it was sent to the pathology lab for
this
testing.
This is why nurses rock.
This is why nurses are amazing. You guys, we love you.
We notice the details.
Nurses, nurses' aides, lab techs, phlebotomists, PAs, NPs, MDs, DOs.
And the doctor. All of you.
We love you all. So, and of course, all of that testing came back positive for massive amounts of insulin. Now,
meanwhile, is nobody noticing that all this insulin's gone?
So, no.
Where did it go? Because you didn't have to keep track of it, right?
Exactly. It's just like an over-the-counter. It's, it's just like, whatever, I guess we must have a lot of fucking diabetic patients lately. Like, here's some more insulin. To stock your floors. That's literally how it was. Yeah, I shit you not. So now people started really analyzing these heparin bags that they were getting back to the lab, and they started finding these series of tiny needle sticks in those rubber stoppers on the bottom. So this raised a concern that somebody is obviously poisoning these bags of heparin that are in storage at St. Barnabas, and they dug back and realized that there may be a connection. Now, in the coming days, again, this is only days after Pam, we love Pam. This is only days after our favorite girl, Pam, found that one bag and, like, raised this concern. So now the staff is realizing that they're just starting to have, like, multiple hypoglycemic events on their floor. And so frequently that they're, like, overlapping. And they're like, we can't even manage all of these
still
crashing
on the
patients.
Still on the burn unit, right?
Yeah. Still on the burn unit. So... I'm sorry. So these patients are in the critical care unit, and he's sometimes moonlighted there.
Oh.
And so he, like, poisoned all their floor stock or something. I don't know. He's a psycho. Sidebar, both of these patients survived.
Yay. Oh, good.
Yay for Ann and Fred.
Ann and Fred.
Yes.
Good job, Ann and Fred.
Yes. So at first, administration thought maybe these are med errors. Let's you know, maybe these patients are getting too much insulin, but most of these patients weren't even diabetic at all, and there would be zero reason for them at all to have gotten insulin. So the likelihood that all of these patients were getting massive amounts of insulin when it wasn't even the right patient, the right dose, the right all of those five rights, they're out the window. Being like a double or triple error would be pretty much unheard of.
Right.
So a massive investigation was launched internally, and they investigated patient visitors. They investigated all of the staff. Once the visitors were ruled out, they started interviewing the staff, like, one by one. So leading the investigation within the staff was a guy named Joe Barry. He was the vice president and a 30-year police veteran.
Ooh.
I know. I'm like, yeah, Joe Barry. Okay.
You go, Joe Barry.
He was, like, uniquely qualified for this whole situation.
Yeah.
Now, there was a huge internal review of the staff and the whole schedule, like who was working on
who
what
was
shifts.
During these 3 days.
Exactly, trying to, like, identify patterns from there. And Joe Barry found that there were only 3 nurses that were working every single event. And, of course, Charles Cullen was one of them.
But so, even to say he didn't even really necessarily have to be. If he had done that all in one day,
it could have just happened. Exactly.
But I understand their theory.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So Barry notes that during the staff interviews, all the staff were, like, upset, nervous for their jobs, concerned that maybe they have unintentionally, like, hurt someone or made a mistake, but not Cullen. Now, he noted that he was, like, not nervous at all about anything, and he genuinely seemed completely apathetic towards the entire situation. And that, like, was the first red flag.
He's like, first for the hospital,
who the fuck does this guy think he is? Like, he's just, like, fine with everything.
We have a massive problem on our floor, and exactly, you can care
less. He's like, meh. Like, meh. Like, literally, meh.
Meh.
So...
Meh.
This, like, really made Joe Barry, like, very suspicious. And on a subsequent interview, he actually, like, crossed his arms and flat out refused to answer questions. Okay, so to me, that's, like, basically, like, I'm guilty and I'm not going to talk to you. Like, that's, I don't interpret that any other way. Exactly.
Right.
So at this point, investigators are like, so...
We're going to narrow in on this guy,
right? I mean, right? So
I mean, because as nurses, we all want to help somebody. We all want to figure it out. We all want to know, why is this happening?
Exactly.
What's going on? And this guy's just like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Not me.
Now, this is a direct quote taken from the book that was like my source material for all of this. And the book is wonderful, by the way. It's called The Good Nurse. It's by Charles Graber. And I mean, this book goes into so much detail about the investigation, the interviews, and I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It's amazing. And what Joe had asked him, quote, I know you put something in those IV bags, end quote. And Charlie's response to that was, you can't prove anything. So, I mean, like, again, that's him being like,
again,
fuck you guys, I did do this.
Instead
and fuck
of saying,
you.
No, yeah. I did not. What are you talking about?
Nobody, no non-guilty person in their right mind would ever say that
you
when
can't
being investigated.
Prove anything.
Exactly. So they alerted police from there. Okay,
thank
so they
God.
Did the right thing. So Police Chief Don Jones of Livingston PD was the lead investigator there. Barry collected a lot of evidence on Cullen, and he worked really hard developing, like, these timelines of the schedules, and it all pointed very clearly towards Charles Cullen. And the thing is, though, it's all circumstantial. Like,
right.
without seeing the guy do this and
right.
proving that he did mm-hmm. that, it's all just, like,
it's all theoretical.
Point. Exactly.
It's all theoretical, but, yeah, where's your hard, concrete evidence?
So even though Charles was, like, a bit of a dick for saying, you can't prove anything, like, he's not wrong. You can't prove anything.
Right.
So they even went as far as to try to catch him in the act, because they knew that that's really what they would need. They would need, like, an admission of guilt, an eyewitness, or... to catch him in the act physically. And unfortunately...
That means putting him back on the floor treating patients.
I know, exactly. Well, that's
what
thing.
That means.
That's exactly what that means. And Charles Cullen, it was all circumstantial. Despite everything they were trying to do, they could not catch him in the act.
I mean, I get it. I get
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Exactly. I get it, too. Because they were... You know, you can't just, like, arrest someone and not have anything. Like, you have to...
I get it.
You have to have the right thing.
You can't arrest him, but
exactly.
can you fire him?
Oh, yes, they can. And in fact, in late 1991, Charles Cullen was fired from St. Barnabas. And the problems with insulin-tainted heparin bags mysteriously vanished along with his departure.
Go figure.
I know, right?
Huh.
Okay. So, through the investigation, he was able to, like, explain it all away to Adrienne as, like, this internal political issue and... It involved him, like, only a little bit, and he was like, there's this impending nursing strike, and he was, like, being made the scapegoat. And so Adrienne was like, I feel like there's more to this, but, like, you're not letting me in, so, like, what am I gonna do? She's, like, more confused at this point. She's mm-hmm. like, obviously something's going on. I don't know. So he did open up about the IV bags and how the hospital couldn't figure it out, and he said to her, like, She said that during this conversation, he was, like, excited when he was, like, talking about how they couldn't figure out who it was and somebody was spiking the heparin.
He was bragging.
Bags. And it was like he was
bragging.
It was
bragging. Like a game for him. Look
it was
what
like
I did.
Was
they don't
like
know.
Reliving, like, his glory. Like, he was getting off to it, which is, like, gross. And so she like, ignored the little voice that was like, this is all pretty fucked up. She ignored that voice. She ignored it. Now, in 1991, also, they had another kid. Just so you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So
So that's going to be really screwing
this
them up.
Is I'm so sorry. I told you 1991, but it's actually January of 92. So it was the first month
early
of 92. And her name, and I hope this I'm saying this right, is Saskia. Saskia?
Saskia.
Saskia. S A S K I A. It's a beautiful name actually.
Shauna
and Saskia.
Shauna and Saskia.
Yes, ma'am. Yep. So in the same month that she was born, he began working at Warren Hospital in their ICU. Now, Adrienne notes around this time, his drinking starts to escalate. His weird behavior starts to escalate. And her suspicions were, like, becoming pretty impossible to ignore. So pets continued to, like, disappear and die, including Lady.
Oh, I know. Lady.
Lady, no. We love Lady.
Lady.
So, unfortunately, Lady, like, disappeared, and he, again, stuck with this whole, like, oh, well, she ran away. And, like, I did nothing about it because I don't give a fuck because I'm Charlie.
Follow your gut, girls.
Yes.
Follow your gut.
So, she really wanted to save the marriage, though. So she, like, tried. She tried really hard. We also love Adrienne. We love Pam. Adrienne. We love Adrienne. We love Pam. We love some people in this story. We don't love Charlie.
No.
Charlie kind of sucks.
I started to have a feeling for you, Charlie.
I empathize with Charlie's early life.
Yeah.
And with his mental health struggles. And but the you fact take that an oath as a help.
Nurse. Well, you that's take an oath as a nurse.
You do take an oath. So things are really getting, like, pretty shitty in this household. And then she really did try, though. She's like, you need to get help with your drinking, and you need some mental health support. And he basically was like, no, I'd rather just spend all my time in the basement and ignore you completely.
If people start spending time a lot in the basement, isn't that alarming?
So I would say yes, but, like, look at us right now. We're in my
basement. We are in the basement.
Recording a podcast.
I get that. But that's usually not a good sign, right?
I mean, you would think, yeah. Except
we're totally doing fine down here.
I work out down here. It's really nice basement. Sometimes when I'm in a good headspace. In November of 1992, she files for divorce.
Good girl.
Girl, finally Adrienne. Gets it. Adrienne, she gets it. Oh. So he was served with his legal papers at work in front of his coworkers in the ICU at Warren Hospital. And this, like, really fucking pissed
normally
him
I'd
off.
Be like, that a girl.
I know. But this really pissed him off. He was, like, not okay. He was
turning
like,
a psycho into more of a psycho.
He was humiliated, and he had another suicide attempt where he ingested a bunch of pills, ended up in the hospital.
Why am I feeling bad for him?
I know. Well, the thing is, we do feel bad for his lack of support during his many, many cries of help.
Mental health awareness. Yeah. I am so glad
I know.
That it has come a long way than it was in the 70s, 80s, and
90s. I know it. I know it.
We still could do far better.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
We still could do worlds better.
So there was some psychiatric hospital stays for Charlie. Now, after a couple of his suicide attempts, he would, like, go to the ED, get treated, and then, like, get transferred to, like, an inpatient psychiatric facility, and then, like, graduate from that program, have outpatient follow-up, and then have, like, an event where he crashes and the exact same cycle would happen over again. So, this essentially happened many, many times. Now, in January of 1993, after another suicide attempt, Charlie was treated in the hospital for this attempt. And then from there, he was transferred to an inpatient psychiatric hospital called Muhlenberg in Bethlehem, PA. And he completed his treatment there. And while he was there, he befriended a nurse that he worked with in the ICU in Warren Hospital named Michelle. We love Michelle also.
Good. Okay. I am loving the strong female women that we are female women.
Wait, well, hello. Female women? Yes, I also love the
I am
female.
Loving the strong female vibes we are getting from these women.
We like these women.
In this story.
We very much love these women. So, she had some of her own mental health issues.
Fair.
And Charlie felt that they really understood each other, and they were both very upfront with each other's mental health struggles, his suicide attempts, his drinking, and they really, really hit it off.
And this was how soon after the divorce?
This was in 93, so it was about a year later.
Okay.
So they bonded, and he, you know, he said, will you go out with me? And she was like, meh.
Check
I
mean, yes
you,
or
you
no.
You weird me out. I guess I'll go to, like, one date. She said yes to one date. She was also a newly divorced single mom. Aww. She was, like, really looking for some friendship, some support. He wanted more. He's like, this is my new, like, woman. And you know him.
The obsessiveness.
Will, like, latch on to this lady. So he was like, yes, like, bring it on. So he visited. He started getting really obsessive. Like, he started doing the showering thing, but it was, like, unsolicited.
Did she welcome it, or did she put the brakes on?
She was like, we went to dinner one time, and, like, you know what? That's it for me. He showered her with attention, with gifts. He showed up at work on his days off to, like, unannounced completely, to, like, go visit her. And he even brought her a ring at work and was like, will you marry me? And she was like, fuck no. Like, he like professed his love for her like publicly, and she just like shot him down. And I mean, he just is so codependent, and right now he has no one to give that to. He's divorced. He doesn't have his wife.
He keeps no relationship with the children, right?
Pouring. He like becomes very obsessed with Michelle. Very obsessed. Now, she tries to distance herself at this point. She's like, this is getting unhealthy. He's obsessing.
Let him down easy.
Exactly. So he called her incessantly. She wouldn't answer, obviously, because it was always Charlie. Eventually, Charlie got a call back from Michelle's ex. So remember, she was newly divorced. So eventually, after no answer from Michelle, Michelle's ex calls Charlie up. And he tells him, dude, you better back the shit off from Michelle. So Charlie,
ex-husband coming to her back.
I like it. So Charlie does not react well to this, though. Does not react well at all.
Of course not.
So he was fucking livid. He was like, she's back with her ex. So he would drive by her condo and like sit outside in his car waiting and watch her. He would drive like back home to check his answering machine just in case she like called him back while he was gone. Like it was a whole weird thing that he was doing. So he would follow her. She noticed that he was out like following her like while she was shopping. He even once broke into her condo. So
what?
This is what happened. So
stalker.
I know. So he breaks a window to get into her condo at night. Somehow this does not wake her up. I don't know if she, you know, there was maybe a fan. I don't know.
Oh, God.
Like she didn't wake up. He just went into her bedroom and fucking watched her sleep. I know.
Don't we all have that like crazy thing?
I feel like people who have like,
I just got the goosebumps.
Based like good mental health just don't do that. They don't do that. You don't do that. So
watching somebody in their most vulnerable state.
He watched her sleep. Exactly. So he leaves. He then called Michelle the next day, and she answered because she knew that this was Charlie. He told her over the phone, yeah, that was me. And she just was like, okay, and like hung up the phone, panicked, calls the police on him. This whole ordeal,
poor Michelle,
led to another suicide attempt for Charlie with Xanax and Darvocet, apparently, which is something he just like, I guess, had on hand.
So, Okay. I feel like I have to say something, and yes, I don't want to sound insensitive or what.
That's all good.
He figured out that he can't be proven by putting insulin in all the heparin drips and whatnot, and yes. How he could kill all these other patients. But he's had how many unsuccessful suicides?
So many.
He could figure out how to kill them, but not himself. Again, I'm not trying to sound insensitive.
No.
So
I
was this attention?
A lot of this, Devin, was attention and was a cry for help.
And I don't want to downplay.
And he just was not getting it. No, anybody's
suicidal attempts. Yes. It is a very, very serious thing.
Very serious.
I'm just confused by somebody's knowledge on how to do this to somebody else.
Yes.
But all of his attempts have failed.
Lots of failed attempts. So I agree with you, and I share your theory that a lot of this was more of a cry for help and seeking attention than actually
trying to
kill himself. Although he does report that he often fantasizes about dying and killing himself and the various ways that he could do that. So after this suicide attempt or what have you, he ended up at Greystone, which is another psychiatric hospital, and he did really well there. He was concerned about keeping his job at Warren, but they wanted him to work. So back to work he went once he was discharged from Greystone. So I feel like here is a good place to stop. And we're going to continue with part two. And in part two, we're going to talk about more of his crimes and the investigation, the arrest, and where we are at today.
Oh, this is heavy.
I'm telling you, this is heavy. A doozy, man. This is heavy. Is really a doozy.
Oh, so, thank you for all your diligence and your research and everything that you've done.
You know, like, I really enjoyed it.
It's made me have a hard time with this because I'm feeling for the guy.
Yeah.
But yet you've murdered people.
Well, that's the thing, right?
You're bringing all these girls down.
Exactly. That's really the thing. These people, they come from sadness. Right. A lot of times the childhood is very, very sad for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel for them to an extent, but a lot of people come from a sad background and a sad childhood, and most of them don't murder people.
True.
So, true. I, you know...
Valid.
You know, a lot of people come from a broken home, come from sadness, but they don't murder people.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
All right. So, well, so thank you for coming along on the ride on our first podcast.
This is great. We do have one piece of business before we close out.
Oh, the business part. Yes, the business. It's not all fun and games. It's business.
Right, exactly. So we have a Patreon shout out to do.
Ooh, okay. Patreon.
Our first Patreon shout out ever goes to Miss Diane Grouch.
Whoop, whoop, Diane.
You are a beautiful sea
mermaid.
Thank
you for supporting us. Sea mermaid.
Yeah, no, yes. Sea mermaid.
All right.
She is a beautiful walking sea mermaid, and we love you so much. Thank you so much for your
support. Thank you, Diane. You're awesome.
Also, if you're feeling so inclined, if you would mind giving us a follow on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast, follow us on Twitter at Med Crimes PC, or find us on Facebook, Med Crimes Podcast.
Here we are. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
We'll see you for part two.
This is Kate and Devin.
Okay.
See ya.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway, because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time.
For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.